Good afternoon, Sonoma County and the world. The time is 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS-LP, Cal's Radio. Broadcasting live from Occidental, California at 107.3 on your FM dial and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm, bringing you the Mystical Positivist for the next 2 hours. Cal's Community Radio thanks Many Rivers Books and Tea for their generous support. Many Rivers specializes in tools for spiritual practice, including books, candles, and sacred art. Many Rivers carries fine loose-leaf teas and teaware. They also host spiritual talks and classes. Many Rivers is located at 130 South Main Street in Sebastopol. You can phone them at area code 707-829-8871 or visit them on the web at www.manyriversbooks.com. Cal's Community Radio sends a big thank you to Occidental Hardware. From building materials to office supplies, Occidental Hardware, they have the stuff. Located at the corner of Hill Street and Bohemian Highway in downtown Occidental. Find them online at www.occidentalhardware.info or call them at area code 707-874-3441. This is a reminder that Cal's Community Radio is membership supported, and we currently have an Indiegogo campaign going on right now, trying to raise money to keep operation of the station. We have many levels of membership that are available through Indiegogo. You can go to www.kows.fm to find the link to the Indiegogo campaign, and we look forward for your support. Cal's Community Radio is basically run by volunteers, but there are real costs associated with keeping the station running, from equipment to projects to move the antenna to better coverage in the Sebastopol area. We definitely have costs that are required to keep the station going. So we would appreciate your support and your joining of the herd. This week, our guest in the studio is Russell Dellman. Russell studied Zen meditation, yoga, Gestalt therapy, and the Feldenkrais work, and became one of the first authorized to teach Feldenkrais professional trainings. He's the founder of the Embodied Life School and the mentorship program trainings, which he offers internationally. We'll get started after a short musical break. We'll be listening to selections from a CD called Attend, O Heaven, Hymns of the Great Lent and Pascha, performed by the St. Seraphim Orthodox Choir in Santa Rosa. So we'll be right back.
Behold, our church is clothed in a beauty that
This is The Mystical Positivist, a radio show dedicated to the application of reason in the pursuit of spiritual practice and development. It consists of commentary, book reviews, interviews, and discussion in and around the local and larger spiritual community. The thesis of the show is that rationality is in no way the antithesis of deep mystical experience. In fact, we assert that it is a necessary ally. I'm your host, Stuart Gudnick, The Mystical Positivist. Joining me in the studio is my co-host, Dr. Robert Schmidt. Rob is the director of Taiyu Meditation Center and founder with myself and Jim Wilson of Many Rivers Books and Tea in Sebastopol.
Happy to be here on Holy Saturday.
This week, our guest in the studio is Russell Dellman. Russell began his study of body-mind perspectives and human potential in 1969 as a student of psychology. His lifelong commitment to awareness and freedom began consciously at this time, along with his practice of Zen meditation. Through workshops at the Esalen Institute, living at the Gestalt Institute of Canada, travels in the jungles of South America, being trained as a yoga teacher, and studying Gestalt therapy with Robert Hall, he deepened his self-knowledge. His training and deep personal relationship with Moshe Feldenkrais began in 1975 during the first professional training program offered in the U.S. In 1984, Russell became one of the first people in the world authorized to lead Feldenkrais professional training programs. Since that time, he has taught more than 40 of these programs internationally and directed or designed 10 others. Russell has helped in the training of more than 2,500 Feldenkrais teachers. In addition, he maintains a private practice at his home in Northern California and teaches public workshops throughout the world. Along with his wife, Linda, also a Feldenkrais trainer, he created the Feldenkrais India Project that brought the method to India for the first time. Through work at Mother Teresa's missions, particularly in Calcutta, the Dellmans taught the Sisters of Charity to work with brain-injured children. During this time, they were blessed and influenced by numerous private meetings with Mother Teresa. In addition to all of the above, perhaps the strongest influences in Russell's life are his more than 30 years of relationship with Linda and the journey of fathering his daughter Lily. The formation of the Embodied Life School and the mentorship program is the fruition of a lifelong trajectory. Russell Dellman, welcome to The Mystical Positivist.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
So our custom is in these interviews is to begin by asking our guests to describe their religious or spiritual impressions from the early part of their life and to give us a sense of what early experiences really kind of combined to give you the trajectory that your life has been on.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I have to say that my home life was completely barren, we could say, or free in another way from any specific spiritual traditions. My parents were not religious or spiritual in any particular way. They were thoughtful. And my mother particularly was a very perceptive and intuitive type, but not part of any tradition. But looking back to how I started in all this, I read an article when I was 18 years old on Zen meditation, and something happened inside where I started to sit and never stopped. So looking back from that point of view, what would have been living in me that many people read articles and don't start a spiritual practice that stays with them throughout their life? So looking back from that point of view, I would say there was a way in which my mother was connected to herself that in sometimes very difficult ways, because she had a lot of individual problems, a lot of mental instability, but she was also very interested in the truth, what was going on in this situation. And that sparked something in me that I believe tapped into that article later on.
So did you at that time have any formal or become involved in any formal zendos, or was it just on the strength of the article and the description?
Well, you know, this was, now it's 1970 that I'm starting to sit, and in Pennsylvania, and I was sitting on my own starting to read books on Zen, and there just happened to be in the hillsides recently started a Korean Zen center. I went there, totally overwhelmed by sitting so long. I went twice, got some feel for what maybe authentic Zazen was like, and then didn't have contact until a year later. I came out to San Francisco and went to the San Francisco Zen Center and had my one personal interaction with Suzuki Roshi's, Shunryu Suzuki, who started the San Francisco Zen Center. And it was actually his article that I had read, and it was his book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that became my gospel in a way. And he became my heart teacher, although I never studied with him directly. It was a student of his who was my main teacher for 30 years. And but there, in my heart, Suzuki Roshi still lives as a guide.
I'm curious, was the Korean Zen community associated with Sansanim?
It wasn't, actually. It was another. I did have some interaction with some of Sansanim's students later when I was more involved with Zen over the years and got to interact with people from different teachers and different communities.
Yeah. So that was the Zen piece,
right.
But at this formative time in your life, you also became influenced on the body piece,
yeah.
And I'm interested in how that got tied in.
So this is really, I guess we all have unusual stories, and for me, going back, again, I need to go back to my mother. She was dealing with manic depression. And I was kind of her confidant and, in a way, her healer in the sense that she'd get so tense. She'd say, could you please rub my legs? And I would rub her legs. When I was 8 years old, she would say, you have the best hands. You're going to be an osteopath someday. And I would say, Mom, I want to be a psychiatrist, because she was seeing psychiatrists all the time. And so from that, there was kind of a simple step. When I was in college, and it was 69, 70, 71, human potential psychology was starting to come in, read this article on Zen, but I was also at the time reading about this Esalen Institute, this mind-body, and I got it right away. I don't know why. I think it was because of this connection to my mother that I started. I went out to Esalen between my junior and between my sophomore and junior year, did a month there, just realized that mind, body, impossible to separate, that we are whole beings, that our spirit, our thinking, just as you said, and I really liked what you said at the beginning about including logic, because any part of the human being that's not included is incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to intuitively get and then spend the last 40 years really mining the territory of what it means, what's the genuine meaning of integration or of wholeness. And so I saw pretty early on that the body, the feeling life, the thinking life, and the spiritual life were one life.
Well, that's interesting because it sounds like your mother's situation was compelling to you even at the age of eight. If you knew at the age of eight that you wanted to be a psychiatrist, then that was, it seems fairly clear, a way to engage with healing in a particular direction that was meaningful and relevant to you at the time.
Yes. And even sitting here talking with you, it feels more present than I've thought about it in a long time. It's like, oh, wow, she was really so formative in my, under the surface in a way, in my process. And the trajectory of my life was remarkable, that as an undergraduate, I found professors that supported this line of inquiry. I was in a conservative psychology program, but had a professor who supported it. I was graduated when I was 20 years old and went to the Gestalt Institute of Canada and then got trained in. So I did all these trainings in yoga, in Gestalt, by the time I was 22 years old. And then I met Feldenkrais. I had heard about him from somebody I respected who said he was the cutting edge of body-mind understanding.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided, well, this would be somebody I'd love to work with. And this is actually another just karmically interesting story. I received in the mail a flyer that he was going to do his first training program. I thought, oh, that's interesting. A little bit later, my mother died. And I inherited $5,000 from my mother, and the program was $4,500. So she also paid for my professional education that brought in this kind of healing and learning through the body, which is a beautiful turn of the wheel.
It is nice. Yeah. It's very nice. Well, so I think this might be a nice time, though, to sort of give our listeners a kind of sense of what Feldenkrais was doing, what you were learning to eventually that you would be teaching, teaching people who would be themselves teaching,
right,
and so forth. So just, if you will, just paint a sketch a picture for us.
Yeah, so it's not easy to describe the Feldenkrais work. It has many different layers to it. At its deepest level, it is work in awareness. That Feldenkrais saw that the human being was whole, and that into that nervous system, into that brain, or we could say into that inner life, was through movement. From his point of view, you could go in through thinking, you could go in through feelings, but if you go in through movement, you get into the earlier structures. What was there before language? Your breathing patterns, your stand, your moving, your sitting, how you mobilize yourself. So he was mostly interested in how a human being engages in life physically as an infrastructure for their relationships, for their ways of feeling towards others. How did they move in relation to others? So he was not spending his time in verbal interaction, but really teaching through the body. There were two forms that he taught in. One is called awareness through movement, that are group movement lessons, very slow. They kind of look a little bit like the rhythm of Tai Chi, but there are thousands of different movement lessons, so you don't learn one form. Most of them are done lying down, and you learn to be aware of your body is one thing. Second thing is you learn to deconstruct some of the habit patterns that you learned by actually giving the nervous system alternative patterns of movement. So they have to be done slowly, otherwise you will mobilize your habit pattern. But he really understood in a remarkably intuitive way for somebody in the 30s that is now being absolutely confirmed by the revolution in neurology, how the nervous system learns and redundant patterns of learning and the whole idea of, that our nervous system, given a certain kind of environment, has plasticity and can grow new patterns of action, new patterns of thinking, new patterns of feeling. So he understood that in an exquisite way. So he developed these movement lessons, but he also developed a hands-on approach that you would have your clothes on. It's not like massage. And he's using his hands, or Feldenkrais practitioner uses their hands, to educate that, you could say that person, you could say that nervous system, for other possibilities, how to turn the head, how to reach their arm, how do they have a habit of holding their breath when they mobilize. So it's gentle movements with the hands to educate the person.
Is the, in the second form, the functional integration form,
yes.
I think.
That's the name of it, yeah.
Is that to draw someone's awareness to a possibility of motion that they may not have awareness of?
That's nicely put. I would say we can think of it in two interacting ways. One is to bring the person's awareness to another possibility. The other is a less conscious learning, that some motor patterns can be learned beneath the level of consciousness. Some of the older parts of the brain can get mobilized, and the person doesn't actually notice a new pattern till later. Hmm. But the system has actually picked up on something.
So is it the communication through this holding and movement of new patterns, or is it also replaying old patterns so that one can have an awareness of what that...
Yeah, that's great. Great observation. It's both of those. One of the things Feldenkrais saw was that you don't only want to learn what's, quote, positive or new, but you want a better understanding of what you already do. And it's a really interesting thought about learning. So sometimes I might have somebody and I'll say, intentionally do what you don't want to do. What an interesting, you know, somebody comes to me, maybe they tend to lift their shoulder every time they have tension up in their neck. I say, well, get really aware of how you lift your shoulder. You know, show me the pattern that you really want to. You're aware that tightens your neck. How do you tighten your neck? Could you do it more slowly? Could you get really aware of how you do that? Now let's see if you could lift your arm in another way. Let me see if I can show you some other possibilities. So you get to know your habit pattern, and you get to know alternatives. It's very interesting to apply that idea about learning to other situations. Like, you know, maybe you get into a stuck pattern with a partner.
Mm-hmm.
What would it be like to actually consciously notice how we get stuck? What we say to each other that produces this reaction? Of course, when you're not activated in the pattern, how to explore it? And your system can learn from what you don't want to do as well as from what's the positive direction.
Got it. One of the things that's coming up for me as you're describing all this is some of the stuff that I've heard a number of spiritual teachers and traditions assert, which is that one of the things that's great for very young, well, babies, young toddlers, kids, etc., is to have impressions of people who have many different habit patterns or many different ways of being in the world, and just have that kind of rich melange of mixture of different possibilities present physically around the child, as opposed to just, you know, a small, more restricted number of folks. And it sounds like that's something that might have been at least part of Feldenkrais's intuition.
I think you're onto something, Rob. He had a very potent early life. He was born in the Ukraine, witnessed pogroms as a young man.
Wow, that's potent.
Left his family at 13 and went with villagers to Palestine. I mean, there are incredible stories from that time. But he saw life in many different levels. And then he was brilliant. He was educated at the Sorbonne. He was brilliant in mathematics. He was an engineer. And he was the highest-ranked Caucasian in judo. He started the Paris Judo School. Hmm. And this is a man, you know, it's an overused term, but he was a Renaissance intelligence, that kind of width.
Mm-hmm.
Also knew J.G. Bennett. Hmm. Although didn't study Gurdjieff work very much, he was influenced by this whole atmosphere of what it means to wake up.
Mm-hmm.
So his respecting, as you're pointing to, two things. One is that the diversity of possibilities is really healthy for the organism. And the two, and this is the most important to me in my work, which has grown way out from the Feldenkrais work, is that there is a knowing of wisdom within us. It's what I call a wisdom body. And that there's a recognizing mm-hmm. of if we're given enough choices and the choices are presented in a way that allows for a safety internally and externally, that the organism tends toward life-giving choices.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really value that point of view quite a bit.
It makes me think, this may or may not be related, but my teacher used to point to studies about toddlers and dietary choices.
Mm.
And he was fond of quoting some work that had been done which said that if you gave a toddler or a set of toddlers basically a plate with all these different choices of food, they might, for a day or a week or whatever time period, eat exclusively just one food or maybe two or three and then not eat the other ones.
Mm.
But that over time, the tendency was to actually to eat what nutritionists would call a balanced diet.
Really?
And the only thing that would throw it off was sugar.
Mm-hmm.
If you put sugar in the food, that would throw off their intuition, innate intelligence in this area.
That's brilliant. Yeah, that sounds right. I have not seen the work, but something about it sounds right.
Yeah,
yeah.
But it sounds like that what you're pointing to, and we'll certainly get into this as the conversation develops. But I'm interested to hear more about that in your own work that you've created.
Yeah, yeah, yes.
You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is your host, Stuart Gudnick. Co-host Rob Schmidt and I are speaking with our guest in the studio this week, Russell Delman. Russell studied Zen meditation, yoga, gestalt therapy, psychology, and the Feldenkrais work, and became one of the first authorized to teach Feldenkrais professional trainings. He is the founder of the Embodied Life School and the mentorship program, trainings that he offers internationally. So maybe this would be a good time to kind of elaborate now on the Embodied Life School, because I get the sense from some of the background research I did that there are these various sort of rivers of experience that you had that you've combined together into the Embodied Life School. And I think as you elaborate that, we might trace some of those rivers back as well.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, so I had a insight, as I alluded to earlier, that we function as a unity. I saw that fairly early on. What I was very blessed with, and I take no credit for it except responding to offerings in my world, that I had this sitting practice, this core meditation practice. I then had this Feldenkrais deep study of the human body, not as a separate entity, but as a way of entering the totality of a human being, but really through movement, really getting a deep understanding of movement. So I had the sitting practice, I had the movement, and on the other side, we could say the third leg of my understanding, it connects to what is often thought of as somatic psychology or... I don't like the traditional words for it, actually, but it's mm-hmm. what I call guided inquiry. Okay. So the embodied life work stands on three legs that are actually one understanding approached from three points of view.
Okay.
One is a sitting meditation practice that's Zen-based. Another is a movement practice that is mostly Feldenkrais. And the third are a variety of practices that I call guided inquiry. And guided inquiry is based in a work called Focusing by Eugene Genlin, which is a way of listening to your inner life and to listen to the inner life of others. And also certain gestalt practices, gestalt awareness practices, as well as practices that I've grown myself through the influences of nonviolent communication, the influences of my own imagination and my own work with students and seeing where are the gaps in awareness,
mm-hmm.
where are the interactive gaps, because sometimes someone develops quite a bit of self-awareness, but as soon as they're in relationship, it's like it didn't move over there. The earlier idea that some people had, Feldenkrais actually had this idea. This was one of his erroneous ideas, in my opinion, and I think he would agree at this point. We had some conversations about it shortly before he died, actually. Is he predicted that if the motor patterns, if the movement patterns can be sufficiently reorganized, that all the other aspects of the human being will be simultaneously reorganized.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to notice, particularly when I was with him in Israel, that a lot of people who'd worked with him for a lot of years, once the class was over and they went out onto the bus, they were like the other Israelis, pushing you out with their elbows. Interactively, it didn't seem like the kind of awareness that was happening mm-hmm. in the Feldenkrais setting, and maybe even in their home, and it was very nice for their movement, and in certain situations perhaps carried over, really was not generalizing into what I would call their humanness.
Mm-hmm.
That got my attention quite a bit. So I said, okay, people, many of us have certain narrower bands of great development that are not generalizing to other parts of ourselves. So I became very interested in what were the key doorways that if someone had enough physical awareness and they had enough ability to sit quietly with themselves and learn some communication and interactive skills, would those begin to cover the ground for the entirety of that human being to really live differently, not only for themselves, but be able to offer a different gift to the world? Because if our spiritual path, in my opinion, does not become a giving, does not become an offering to the world, then something's missing. And so I'm looking for what is needed for this person to be whole enough in themselves that the most natural thing in the world is to want to take care of life.
So did
thank you.
Yeah.
Did this arising or this kind of profound intuition just work on you for a while? You saw these gaps like the one you described. Yes. With the Feldenkrais method.
Yes.
Was there an analogous gap that you noticed with the Zen meditation, for instance?
Yes. I would say one of the things that began to stand out to me was people who would have a beautiful meditation practice, maybe 30 years of sincere, dedicated practice. But outside the Zendo and outside certain corridors in their life, there were real gaps. Often it was a relationship gap. And then I would see people who had kind of specialized in communication or relationship, more the psychological, what we think of as the psychological side of things. And they would often have a very great difficulty just being quiet in themselves and at ease with without a lot of stimulation or a lot of interaction. So I began to see in the Feldenkrais world certain gaps. Wonderful people, good development. I'm not criticizing it in any way, but just from my intuition and my sense of what is whole, there were gaps. Same in the Feldenkrais world, same amongst my friends who were more specialized in communication or in more psychological ways of approaching life. So there was this intuition that was living in me that these are such wonderful people that have this gap. I was blessed, not that I've got any kind of perfection because I'm working on everything always, but there was a sense that, oh, if this person could have more sense of themselves physically, their way of living would really be different. Or if this person could see the effect they're having on the people around them by the words that they're using, their life would be really different. And so that led to it was an interesting moment for me. So this was back in the early 2000s. I was teaching a lot of Feldenkrais trainings and loving them and respecting them. So it's important to me that that's clear, that my movement into the embodied life was not Feldenkrais isn't good. It's wonderful. But I actually had this question come to me after a rather deep meditation. Was, if I had 5 years left to live, what would I be doing? Mm-hmm. It was a profound moment for me. And it got absolutely clear that I've been given these gifts in this life to encounter a sitting practice that I just took to when I was 18 years old, that these ways of approaching awareness through communication and through my embodiment, I would be teaching all that I learned. I would be doing a much more holistic program than what I'm actually teaching. And to teach what I wanted to teach in a Feldenkrais training environment was not respectful of the Feldenkrais community, because it had certain definitions of what the work was. So I'd already been leading retreats and workshops in what I was calling the embodied life. I coined that term back in the early 90s. But it was now...
But those were separate from the Feldenkrais.
Those were next to.
Okay.
So separate meaning the embodied life retreats would include Feldenkrais lessons.
I see.
But also the sitting and also the other kinds of inquiry.
Okay.
And in fact, for the first 10 years, probably 70% of my students were Feldenkrais related, either practitioners or, because that was the community that knew me.
Mm-hmm.
That's changed in more recent years, where I have still Feldenkrais people, but a much wider range of people. So here it was back in maybe 2004, where I said, wow, I still love doing the Feldenkrais trainings, and not only love it, it's my means of support. I've got a daughter who's, I want to go to college, and I'm going to, you know, that I'm living in the material world, and that was part of it also. But I realized that the direction was to move from spending so much time teaching a more limited part of my overall vision to creating context to bring my whole teaching forward. So then around 2006, I started doing Embodied Life Mentorship Program, which meets two times a year, two residential weeks each year for 3 years. So it's a three-year program, and people do a lot of practice on their own in between. And we have these very powerful meetings twice a year where we're working with all three of these legs that we're standing on. And then they also interact in between. And so that's the Embodied Life Program.
Got it. One observation that's interesting to me about this is that our own tradition has been very informed by the Gurdjieff work. And within that work, there's a very clear model that the human organism has an intellectual center, a feeling center, and a moving and instinctive center. And that each of those centers represents a separate and autonomous brain, and that it's actually the work of spiritual transformation requires that each of the brains, which speak a very different language, be addressed, and that presence be brought into each of those centers. Otherwise, one becomes somewhat lopsided.
Mm. Well, that sounds really great. I would speak about it a little bit differently, which is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I would say they're three separate unless they are integrated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Stuart didn't go on to say that Gurdjieff's idea was about harmonization of those three centers.
Yeah.
But in the sense that they're separate, they do represent different ways of relating to the world.
Right, right. Well, especially when one is dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And some have atrophied or some have not been brought forward. But when there's an integration, we can have, you know, somebody could be more of a feeling person or more of a thinking person, but as long as there's enough from all these and that they're functioning harmoniously, then you have the grounds for a truly creative human being who is feels not only integrated in themselves, because one of my insights that came through Feldenkrais, but also through Eugene Genlin and through my own sitting practice, is you can't be integrated in yourself. You can only be integrated in yourself in the world.
In relationship to the rest
right.
of the world.
Exactly.
That, yeah.
Exactly.
That's actually, I think that's a very profound realization, and is, I mean, it's in one sense, it's another way to restate the bodhisattva ideal, I would assert, although it doesn't sound exactly the same, but I think there's a lot of resonance there. But it's also it's something that I've been looking at myself a lot recently. So it's very resonant to hear you talk about it.
Mm.
Perhaps you can tell us more about your relationship with Genlin and his work and how that helps play a part in the embodied life mentorship program.
Sure. So again, it's a good story, I think.
Good stories are good on the radio, man. We like good stories.
Oh, I'm glad. So I was, teaching my workshops and seminars and beginning to teach the meditation. This is back in the late 90s, and I was teaching the meditation and teaching some Feldenkrais and teaching these inquiry processes. And I was in Munich. And somebody came up to me and said, "Wow, that process was amazing. You must have studied with Gene Genlin." And I said, "Well, no, I saw his book years ago. Mm-hmm, I never read it, but I know the name. But your language." And then the next day she says, "Well, I'm a focusing teacher." And she printed out some pages of some books. I said, "Oh, there are a lot of similarities." So then, about a year later, the same thing happened again. It was a focusing teacher in one of my seminars saying, "Oh, you've said..." I said, "No." So then it's a couple of years after that, and a good friend, an old, beautiful rabbi, I don't know if you know the name Zalman Schachter, a well-known rabbi.
So yes. Never met him, but I certainly know the name.
Well, Zalman and I were got connected in 1978 in Philadelphia, which is where he lived, and I was a Feldenkrais teacher. And he came to me for his back, and we got to be good friends. So I got to divert into this story before
next one. More stories,
good,
that's good.
Right? Stories are good. So Zalman, wonderful man. We still have a sweet connection, and he's precious. So he would say to me, "Russell, you got to help me because I have my weekend workshops and the people are so out of their bodies. It takes so long. You come Friday night. You do a little of your this and a little bit of your that. Then you get them in their bodies. You get them breathing. And then it's much easier for me to teach." So I would go out and teach the first night of his workshops. So Zalman and I, once a year, we talk on the phone, twice a year. So he was asking what you're doing. This is like maybe 2000, 2001. He starts saying, "You gotta go talk to my friend Gene Genlin. You're hearing the same muse. You're hearing the same muse." And then I'd speak to him again a year later. "You gotta speak to my friend Gene." So then, after these people came up to me in the workshop, and then Zalman said, "I go, okay, I'm a little bit shy about this, but out of the blue, Zalman gave me his phone number. I called him up, and he was very gracious. And so then I went over to visit him in New York. He's now about 86 years old, but still, he's got the most incredibly lucid thinking of any human being I've ever met, actually, his thinking processes. We met and just had a connection, and we've maintained this connection ever since. And since then, I've studied focusing and realized, wow, he went a lot further than I did in so many ways in this. So that really fed into the program I was growing.
Oh, cool.
And so I kind of backdoored my way into focusing by doing something that was very focusing-like. But then by learning focusing, it really added to what I was doing.
Can you, just for the benefit of listeners who may not be familiar with focusing, give a brief outline of what that practice is?
Yeah, good idea. So focusing is a way of listening to what's living in you at any given moment. And let me try to describe that. So when we hear the word body, we think physical body, the skin and the bones and the muscles. But from a focusing point of view, we would change it a little bit. We would say, you live in a bodily process, or you live as a bodily process, meaning that every feeling that you have, sad, glad, the traditional emotions, or even something like a tired, energized, any way that you would use the term how you feel, actually is a bodily experience that is being sensed or verbalized through your thinking processes. When you come up with the word, oh, I'm feeling interested in what I'm saying right now. I'm curious about how this conversation is going. And I feel a lot. So then I would look in my body and go, well, this, how do I know I'm curious and interested in a lot? Well, I've got this excitement in my chest. I've got a feeling of good energy, a sense of looking in each of your eyes and getting a response in my body that I can interpret, that I can know, that says, oh, I'm feeling comfortable, I'm feeling open, I'm curious. How do I know those things? Because there's a bodily referent that originally, even before we learned intricate language, we were feeling organisms. How does an infant learn what frustration is? Just as an example. And I'm not saying it's always like this, but to try to get the listeners to understand the way I'm talking about listening to your body. So let's say you're breastfeeding, if you're lucky. You're breastfeeding at your mom, and you're interrupted. Doorbell rings. Your mom puts you down. You're still hungry. And you, ma'am, I want more, ma'am. Later on, something like that bodily feeling may turn into a word like frustration. So we can say that when we are conversing, we are actually always referencing what's living in us. So it's not that the feelings live separate, or they interact with our symbols, with our thoughts, and focusing is a way of learning that language, the language of our inner life.
So is it a process of being present to the arising of, let's call it, internal phenomena?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. It's being present to the arising of internal phenomena as you're also aware of the phenomena around you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this interacting of, well, as you all know from meditation practice, that eventually, if you deepen enough in your experience, the terms inner life and outer life begin to become irrelevant. What is there is a living. And the living, of course, it's essential for any healthy person to know what's inside and outside their body, but the actual experience of living is an integration of the external and the internal into one world. The inner world and the outer world become a living experience.
And I guess I'm drawing the distinction of when I use a term like be present too,
yes,
in that you're not describing a cognitive process.
Right.
And that I'm not coming up with a prescription to say, right, that this particular twitch in my shoulder,
right,
corresponds,
right,
to a an external phenomenon,
right,
of you know, someone I don't like walks by.
Right, right. Yes.
It's more of a descending into the body, in a sense, as the point of origin of,
right,
the other processes, the other cognitive processes, and the like.
Yes, and what gets really interesting there, Stuart, is to recognize that what you're tuning into bodily interacts with your symbols for it, with your thoughts about it, your images of it, that they don't live just in separate worlds, oh, that's my thought and that's my feeling, but especially when we're in good tune with our inner life, our symbolizing will match what's living in us. And then it starts feeling more harmonious when our sensations, our feelings, and our symbols can be thoughts or images, are all in alignment. We feel whole. We feel, okay, I know myself in this moment.
It's interesting in our own practice, the approach to this understanding comes more from the point of view that one of the most powerful ways to disidentify with our psychological persona is to recognize the phenomena of whatever it is, a feeling, a thought, an emotion, as it manifests in the body. Because when we put attention on the body, we're not really, the body is very objective. Mm. And I think I read in some of your work, you say the body is in present time.
Yes.
No, the body isn't a repository of story. Our stories are the thought structures that kind of make sense out of the feelings that we're having.
Yes.
And so when we come back to the body in this way that you're describing, we have a very clear, immediate experience of the energetic nature of whatever the manifestation is, and it provides freedom from not having to be identified with the simple structure.
That's great. Can we go to another level of intricacy?
Yeah.
So at another level, we could say, well, our history is living in our body, that our bodily patterns contain some of our traumatic responses to life, some of the ways we've learned to contract in our abdomens. But when we can bring a fresh aliveness to these places, to these contractions, maybe not at first, but when these places that have been hurt, wounded, or terrified, learn that they're in an environment, the environment provided by awareness itself, that they're in an environment that's now safe, that's now welcoming, over time, they begin to open, to relax, to ease. At first, they're not. At first, the history is going to be there. And they're not going to just immediately be available. But as we learn to listen well, which in the point of view of embodied life work is learning an unconditional warm-heartedness towards whatever arises, and have particular practices that we do to teach this kind of attitude. And then here's an actually nice way you can see an integration. So we might get aware in a lesson, in a meditation, of a tightness that's very old in our abdomen. And then we might do a movement lesson where you invite the area gently, because the Feldenkrais work is always very respectful. He saw that if the organism or the nervous system feels pressured, it will always regress to a prior state. That under pressure, we can't do new behaviors. We have to go backward. So it's always taught gently, lightly, listening, respectfully, humor in the air, that this isn't just to make it enjoyable, it's because that brings the nervous system into a state where learning can occur, where new learning can occur. So a person's aware of this tightness, they then might do a movement lesson, and that loosens it a little bit. And then they might do a process where they're learning to say hello to this tightness, and you say, hey, I know you're there. Is there anything you'd like me to know? Maybe put your hands on it and just let it be with it. Just kind of be with it. Don't even try to do anything with it. Then tonight's meditation, pay a little more attention to what's going on in your belly. And then the next day, we might do another movement. So you're gradually approaching maybe a very old pattern, but not trying to assault it, not trying to push it away, not trying to cathart it, but giving it an environment in which it feels safe enough to unwind itself. And what Feldenkrais saw, and as Zenlin sees, and I think great meditation sees, is in the environment of this kind of warm-hearted awareness, the organism will tend toward its optimal functioning, that we move in the direction of life-giving responses if we have that possibility, if that possibility can be safe. Yeah. And that's good news. That's really good news, because you don't hear that. We hear a lot about trauma, and trauma is very potent in the body, in the mind, in the interactions and relationships. But that this capacity within us, that something knows, like your little kids picking out food, that something in us knows what it needs, that knowing has gotten interrupted because of our faulty learnings and traumatic experience, and that there are very powerful and reliable ways of actually changing the nervous system so that you return to a state where your inner wisdom becomes available again. That makes me very optimistic for humanity, actually.
Indeed. Yeah. The challenge is, how do we more reliably transmit that understanding?
Exactly. And that's one of the places where I'm so grateful to working through the body, because it's so substantial, that unless our nervous system, and in this case our autonomic nervous system, the stuff that's very deeply connected to our viscera and to our emotions, unless that can be influenced, it doesn't matter how much cognitive learning you have. It doesn't matter even how much spiritual insight you have. The old patterns can still dominate. Mm-hmm. So the deep, and this is now being confirmed in laboratories all over. It's great to be alive in this neurological revolution that's going on, because we can really now see that, a long exhale and a pause actually stimulates the vagus nerve. It stimulates nerves that go to certain parts of your brain that actually create a calming and a safety in the system. That there are certain things, certain kinds of touches, certain kinds of rhythms in the body that can reliably help people to find just what we're looking for, that kind of inner safety that makes it possible that the practices that we do can really go deep. Because we all know people who've been sitting on the cushion for a lot of years, and there's just a level that doesn't get touched.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the things that I remember first. I mean, I was maybe a practitioner for a couple of years, and I met this guy who'd been practicing for 20 or 30 years, I can't remember, and poor guy, you know, he just, his life off the cushion didn't sound like there was, you know, much difference or improvement. So, you know, this point you're making, and then the point about narrowness of development is a very resonant one. Mm. I think it's one of the reasons. I know we have to take a break, so maybe I'll save this point for the part of the conversation that will continue after our break at the top of the hour here. So let's.
All right.
Let me hold on to that.
We will
thought.
Take that break. The time is 5:00 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. This is KOWS LP. Cows Radio, broadcasting live from Occidental California at 107.3 on your FM dial, and streaming live on the web at www.kows.fm. You're listening to The Mystical Positivist. This is Stuart Gudnick. In the second hour of our program, co-host Rob Schmidt and I will continue our discussion with our guest in the studio, Russell Delman. Russell studied Zen, meditation, yoga, Gestalt, psychology, and the Feldenkrais work and became one of the first authorized to teach Feldenkrais professional trainings. He is the founder of the Embodied Life School and the Mentorship Program, trainings that he offers internationally. Chaos Community Radio wishes to thank the Occidental Community Council for their generous support. The Occidental Community Council strives to meet the unmet needs of the Occidental area. The council invites you to attend its meetings every third Saturday of the month at 10:30 a.m. at the YMCA Community Center. Chaos Community Radio wishes to thank Advanced Security for their support. Advanced Security is a family-owned firm providing security and fire alarm systems. Please say you were referred by Chaos Radio. For information online, see advancedsecurity.us or call area code 707-544-9200. So, this Sunday, March 31st at 7 p.m. at Aubergines in Sebastopol, the Spring Istra Celebration with special guest Kim Tripsmith from Cows Radio. From the four directions of the feminine comes the ever-true Fire Witch, a dynamic acoustic electric project from the heart of the Sinkyoni Wilderness. Join these amazing musicians on a journey through an ever-widening world of eclectic instrumentation and provocatively vulnerable, dangerously present song. Special guest Kim Tripsmith also shares her feisty music for an evening that invites you to celebrate springtime, the planting of new seeds and rebirth. That's Fire Witch at Aubergines in Sebastopol. That's Sunday, March 31st at 7 p.m. If you want to find out more about this, go to www.reverbnation.com/Kim Tripsmith. This is just a reminder that Cows Community Radio is membership-supported, and we are currently in the midst of an Indiegogo campaign to raise money for the station. Cows Community Radio is all run by volunteers, but they're real operating costs for the station, so we ask for your support to help keep us on the air. We need new equipment. We need licenses for software programs to allow us to stream effectively to larger communities, and we have lots of projects to move the station to a wider audience. So go to www.cows.fm to find out the link for the Indiegogo campaign and contribute and become a member of the herd. We'll return to the show after a short musical break. We'll be listening to selections from a CD called Attend, O Heaven, Hymns of the Great Lent and Pascha. This is in honor of Easter week. This is performed by the St. Seraphim Orthodox Choir of Santa Rosa. We'll be right back.